Welcome to Writers Talking TV, brought to you by the Writers Guild of Canada. I'm Dennis McGrath. When CBC greenlit Strange Empire, Canada's public broadcaster signaled they were open to dramas that were different, more challenging, for lack of a better phrase, with more of a cable sensibility. Strange Empire is the first test of this new direction. It's a western, set in 1869 on the border of the Montana Territory and the land that's not yet Alberta. The show grapples with issues of racism, violence, the clash of cultures, and most of all, gender. In this western, the brothel owner, sheriff, and doctor are all women, and that focus changes everything. If you've seen creator Lori Finstad Knizhnik's previous show, Durham County, you may know a little of the tone. One thing for certain, CBC has delivered on its promise. It's a bold departure from their recent fare. We caught up with Lori on a cold November night in Toronto at the TIFF Bell Lightbox, where she appeared as a guest of the Canadian International Television Festival. Hi, how you doing?
Good, thanks. How are you?
Good, very good.
Bright lights.
Yes, it's very bright, but you know, it gets homey after a while. It doesn't really. And you know what the weird thing is, the lights are so bright you can actually see them on the podcast. You know, I just want to say...
funnier than I am.
It's all right. I just want to... Yes, but you're way moodier than I am. And better lit. I have a... I want to set the tone a little bit for this sort of thing. It's interesting. Something that happened to me last week. I was in New York with my wife and we saw a play. We saw this play that just opened on Broadway, Jez Butterworth's new play, with Hugh Jackman in it, called The River. And it's this, and it's funny because the whole time I'm watching it, it's very ambiguous, and there's like this pulsing, sinister thing underneath. And I'm sitting here and I'm thinking, this kind of reminds me of Lori's writing a little bit. And the great thing after it was over was this woman comes up in the lobby and she's like, and she hears me and my wife talking, and she's like, can I ask you a question? What was that about? And she was kind of a little at sea because it was very ambiguous, and it made room, it made you feel things, but it didn't necessarily spell it out for you. And I think that we're used to a certain kind of television that does that, and your television never does that. So I guess what I'm asking in the first place is, what was your way in to the world of Strange Empire? Did you start with a scrap of a character? Did you start with a theme? Did you start with the history? How did you get into this subject matter?
Yeah, I like to try to find the consciousness of the of something. And for me, it was that time trying to... I was sliding around in the 19th century trying to figure out what particular period was going to interest me. And trying to find a year. It was going to be 1825 or 1870 or whatever it was going to be. I mean, it depended on all sorts of practical things like where we were shooting and, you know, what was there and all of that kind of stuff too. But more for me, it was trying to figure out what the mindset was back then. And I found this great book that I had known about this book for a long time. I'd seen a film was made of it. A kind of weird documentary, avant-garde type film was made of it. I fell in love with the book because of the photography. I adore photography because you can look at something and go, And when you look at dead people in photographs, you know that they're dead. And that's always been something that really has fascinated me. The book is called Wisconsin Death Trip, and it was a very weird, strange, ambitious historian, very educated man who bought an archive from a newspaper that consisted of old newspapers on microfiche and glass plate photographs that had appeared in newspapers around in this area around Wisconsin. And he picked all of these terrible, terrible things that had happened to people where, you know, children had died in childbirth and people had terrible accidents, and there were all sorts of suicides and incest and, you know, the general kind of stuff that happens to us, too, you know. But to see it in this historical context was really fascinating for me. I was just really engaged by it. And I found the emotional opening there, I think, for who those characters were and what they were up against. And so that was really the first thing that... Mm-hmm. But the photographs are really important. When I was in university years ago, there was Roland Barthes had written a book on photography, mm-hmm. and Susan Sontag wrote a book on photography, and I always really connected with the photography to just help me into the character and see what was I seeing. I never kind of knew, so it was just a spur to imagination.
It's funny because that makes perfect sense to me, you saying that you go into it from a visual perspective. Because the worlds you create, Durham and Strange Empire and stuff, are so richly visual and textual, and it's almost like that thing where, I mean, I'm not a video gamer, but you create worlds that are these tapestries that are these fully inhabited things that they're just hypnotic. It's like, you want to hang around in the world of Strange Empire just because it's so compelling, and you never really do know what's going to happen next. And I that makes sense that your visual in is part of it. The other thing I love about your show is that it evokes in me a very similar reaction to when I watched the pilot of Mad Men. And I remember watching that pilot of Mad Men, and you see all that stuff with Don Draper, and you the beginning of it, you're sitting there and you're thinking, wow, things are really different now, man. Things are so different. Things were so different for the sexes and women back then, and men and gender roles and blah, blah, blah. And you watch it, and as you watch that pilot, you get to the end of the pilot, and by the end of the pilot, you're like, oh, my God, nothing's changed. It's exactly the same. And you gave a great quote where you were talking about working in genre and the way that it allows you to kind of hide things and explore things. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, because I mean, you're always trying to say something. I mean, you want your work to mean something. Mm-hmm. Maybe you don't necessarily know what exactly you want to say, but it's probably generally in the framework of your beliefs and what you think is important. I looked at the Western in the way that, like with Durham, a crime drama, and I was looking at stuff on television and movies and things like that, and I read Mystic River, Dennis Lehane's book, mm-hmm. And it was this essay in social realism and life in the city and the classes and all the... It was like reading Zola. It was like, yeah. Oh, my God, look at this. He's doing this. And it's like this great fucking story. Mm-hmm. It's like... And it moves, you know, and you want to know what happened, and you feel for this character who's been, you know, kidnapped, and... You know, and so I did that with Durham, and it was, you know, it was a great exercise. And I always had a Western in my bottom drawer. Mm-hmm. I just hadn't done anything with it. And then Strange Empire came along. It came along as a log line, basically. What if, you know, these women, their men go out hunting and they don't come back? So basically you're left with all these women. And I just loved it. I thought, that's great. I can work with that. And then I realized that there were really no women in Westerns. There was the virgin, there was the doctor, there was the whore, you know, the madam. And that was basically it. And so it became a process of climbing out of those conventions and those stereotypes and going, well, you know, what was it like? What was it like for them back then? Hmm. So, and what did they do? And so I started reading all sorts of histories and looking at things that women were doing and what life was like back then, and it just moved on from there.
So it was brought to you as a log line. This is something.
Yeah, that was the log line. Yeah. It was you know, nothing more than a log line, quite. Right. Yeah.
What's interesting to me as a viewer watching your pilot is, you know, is again, you start from that point of here are the tropes that you've seen in the Western. We've said, okay, there's the madam, there's the gunslinger, there's the, you know, the virgin that is sort of an outsider, and you know, the medical professional. And in a way, you're starting from these things that we have seen in the Western before, and then then watching the pilot, very quickly you torque each of them. And you keep torquing them till, you know, by the end of that first hour, you're like, I'm not sure who any of these characters are. So how do you do that as a process when you're starting, when you start with this thing, okay, there's going to be a brothel, there's going to be a madam, we're going to have a gunslinger that's half Métis. And then how do you start putting meat on those bones? Is it just, you know, do you just disappear down the, down the slide of your unconscious and just and start pulling it out? Do you have a method to that? How do you approach that?
It was a terrible act, and I always look at it to have killed all of those men. It was a terrible act, and it had all these effects. Mm. And I guess that's how I look at it. Mm. It was a terrible act for them to lose their men and to be put in this position. It's a sex trafficking story is ultimately what it is. That we have that, we've had that through history up to today. And into the future, we'll have that. But the ripple effect of things, you try to feel that in your gut how it felt for John Slaughter, how it felt for Jared, how it felt for Isabel to find out that her husband had done that in order to stalk the cribs, and what you have to take on morally and humanly. Because of an act like that, I mean, it affects everybody. It doesn't. Nobody owns it. Everybody's mm-hmm. affected by it. So, mm-hmm. so it helps you kind of slide into the emotional worlds of the characters, and then you try to figure their reactions to those things, given the perspective they come from. Mm. Somebody like Rebecca, who really doesn't know anything about this place, who's just been kind of planted here. This is a honeymoon trip. And suddenly she's confronted with the most basic survival. It was just it's that single event and how it ripples outward.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I find, we'll certainly talk about the characters as we go along. But what I'm struck by, and I'm not exactly sure how you do it. But by the end of that pilot, you sit there and you think, John Slaughter, the man's clearly the devil. And you do that, and you're sort of left there kind of at the end of the pilot thinking that. And then you spend the next couple of episodes not quite redeeming him, but at least, there's something compelling about him. How do you view that character, and how do you keep that character from tipping over into a cartoon villain? There's something really very deft in how you do that, and I'm not sure what you do. So I'm wondering how you view it.
It's not good enough to be a cartoon. The act there's a point where you really connect with the actor that plays the role, and it's a kind of umbilical thing that happens. And Aaron had gone through this one scene where he is pouring some holy water on himself, and he's feels like he's burning, and he had done such a wonderful job with that particular scene. I was there while he was working his way through it, and he kept crawling off into the dark, into like a place on the set that was dark. And I left him alone there, but he was completely feeling. I think he was feeling completely unsupported, and it really worked for that moment, because that's you have to walk this tightrope and you have to feel like you're falling. So we talked about that, and I think when you have that kind of a relationship with an actor. They can go further and further and further into it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, that's interesting. You touch on that. There is that moment of fear as you're when you're writing the beginning of it, before you got actors involved, before you cast. Were there ever moments where do you sit there writing the part, going, I'm going on a limb here. I hope we find the person that can play this.
Oh yeah, I did that with Rebecca. Yeah. I thought, what are you doing?
Yeah, that was tough.
You're going to find this 20-something, 21-year-old girl who's going to play an autistic savant and is going to be able to pull this off. I never thought I could find her. And we auditioned a couple of people, and then we found Melissa, and I really felt Melissa was the ace in the hole for me, because I had seen her in the movie about the autistic woman who designs the slaughterhouse pens.
Oh, Temple Grandin.
Yeah. She was in Temple Grandin. She played the blind roommate in Temple Grandin,
okay.
Melissa. And that's all I knew of her. And then I discovered that she was on Lost, which I hadn't watched, so I didn't know. But I remember people talking about the pregnant French woman, mm-hmm. and how compelling she was. So then Melissa did this audition, and she just walked away with it. It was astonishing. It was like watching Meryl Streep when she was 20. Mm-hmm. That she hit all the notes with this character, because there were big chunks of dialogue, and they're all period dialogue, and she just got it. She got the intonation, she got the stresses on it, she got the feeling for it. She, wonderful, extraordinary actress. I really didn't think I would be able to find anyone for that part. I thought I was out of my mind writing that part. I really did. Because it would have been, if I didn't find her, it would have just being awful, you know. What was written was not.
Sometimes you got to write and hope the net appears, I guess, is what it.
Yeah,
comes down,
yeah, that's right? What it was. That's what it was.
Since you, this is jumping around a bit, but since you've brought it up, as far as that goes, let's talk. Can we talk a little bit about your approach to the dialogue? There's something very stylized about it. It straddles modern speech, but it also evokes. So that you don't think it's contemporary. There's something. It's not flowery like Deadwood was, or coarse like Deadwood was, but it definitely suggests itself as something other than modern times. How did you develop that voice? Was it just there or?
It appears after a while. Mm-hmm. It's the reading that you do, and you read in period. You read 19th century histories and novels and things like that. You read Elmore Leonard, mm-hmm. and there's a point where it's on your tongue and you can actually feel it. You start to write and you're moving your tongue and that's what's coming out, and you're putting, you know, subjects at the end of sentences instead of at the beginning, and it just happens that way. It mm-hmm. becomes very natural after a while.
Let's talk about go back to the beginning again, and I'm fascinated to find out what the pitch of this show was like, because you know it's a hard thing to wrestle to the ground. You know, feminist Western doesn't really do it justice. You know. It's set in 1869 in the West, but the characters are all women. Still doesn't do it justice. What did you have when you brought it to CBC? What was that pitch like? And what was that process like?
I think it was about 35 pages long, okay. So it was pretty clear what I was going to do. And I was really interested in what in the Western before Main Street. I wanted to see what it took to make Main Street, this mm-hmm. 'cause from nothing, you know. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there were some interesting characters. I remember Cat Ballou. I think I was 9 years old, and Jane Fonda was riding around on this horse in pants, and I was just this. I must have been seven. I couldn't have been nine. and I was just astonished by this. I thought she was just wonderful and sexy and marvelous. And then I watched it again, and I went, oh, my God, that's like so, it's like eons ago, that movie. And then Julie Christie and McCabe and Mrs. Miller. Right. And, you know, you just kind of want to do that again. You want to, and all the women at, you know, Sally Caddo and Katrina Onstad, Helen Azimakis, maybe even Heather Conway. They really responded to that. It was something that hadn't been done I mean, it was like this sort of wonderful group of women. It was what I had as well when I did Durham, when I pitched Durham to TMN, mm-hmm. Michelle Marion. So I don't know, maybe it was something they wanted to see and they responded to it. So. Mm.
Okay, so you get the green light, you get the pickup. Tell me, but you're somebody that traditionally Durham was very much a, you wrote that yourself, you developed that yourself. Strange Empire, you worked a little bit differently. Do you want to get into how that's
sort of worked? Well, I'm not a room writer. I mean, I was in a few rooms, but I generally, I just kind of don't do that very well. So I went out for dinner a couple of times with Peter Mohan and Karen Walton, and asked what's it like to be running a room and doing that whole thing, because I had no idea, whether I could do that. And I ended up with essentially a couple of weekends. It was 8 days to break story, and I ended up with Jackie May, who really got the story and really gets me, and we kind of look at each other and we don't even speak and nod our heads and go off and write. Mm-hmm. And so that was the thing. It was also a first season, so nobody really knew what I had in my mind. So it was kind of like a Vulcan mind meld. That's what I needed to do. So I'm kind of really hoping, because it was a lot of work, 13 hours of television.
Yeah.
I'm kind of really hoping that now that people have seen what I want to do, that some people will think that
now you can find some people to come play with you.
I can find some writers now, please. I need some people to play in the sandbox. Yes.
One of the things that's really exciting about this show, we all know shows that have, let's call them low to medium ambitions, and then there's something that's there's something rambling and epic, and the emotional scope of Strange Empire is so much bigger. But what's great about it is when you have that canvas that's much wider, watching the early episodes of the show, you can see you finding the show as you're doing it. Do you want to talk a little bit about that, the development when you were doing it?
Those first three episodes drove me crazy for several months, and they still drive me crazy because they're still looking around and searching, and there was so much that I wanted to put in there, and I didn't want it to feel wedged in. I wanted it to unfold naturally, particularly the spiritualist stuff, because mm-hmm. that was really, really interesting. It was spiritualism was a huge phenomenon at that time. There were 10 million spiritualists.
Wow.
And it became a way for the suffragettes and women's rights people to get their message across. A lot of them became mediums, and they would invoke, Ben Franklin and Plato and Aristotle and mm-hmm. Voltaire and, the whole gang of guys to say women should have the vote, women should have, the right to divorce, women should, be able to do whatever they damn well please. And it was a kind of sell job, you know, and it was really interesting and really smart to do it that way, because they scared the hell out of people, and they really felt that, that it was great. I just loved it, and I want more and more and more of that.
Right.
So if we get a second season, Strange Empire, we're going to have a theater instead of a church.
Huh.
So I'm kind of excited about bringing some spiritualists and mediums and more crystal balls in there.
Is there a moment in those first few episodes or a scene or a sequence or something where was the first moment that you felt that you'd found the show? That, okay, this is where it's going to be.
I don't know if there was a moment. There's some favorite moments. I mean, when Jamie Serpet crosses the line and Slaughter shoots him, mm-hmm. I liked that. I thought that was really wonderful. It was really a really emotional moment for me. I really loved it. I don't know. I don't know. No, I mean, it's just pieces and bits of things. They're coming together.
Yeah, it's
maybe, I think part of it was the wardrobe for Kara, mm-hmm. because we I was really glad she looked like she could walk out of a graphic novel.
Mm-hmm.
I really liked the silhouette that she cut.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, the hat was a really hard sell at the beginning.
Really?
Nobody wanted the hat. And I'm like, no, it'll be fine.
Oh,
it'll
my
be
God.
Fine.
How, it's such a
it'll
signature of the show.
It'll be fine. You'll get used to it. It'll be fine. You know? And all the corsets are great.
Yeah.
You know? It was just fun, that side of stuff. Costumes and photography and pulling everybody together onto the same page. I love wardrobe. I love the DP and all of that. So,
do you want to talk a little bit about? I've been lucky enough to work in BC a few times, and there's a very different filmmaking culture there. It's really exciting. And you had a lot of interesting directors. Tell me a little bit about some of those other people and what they brought to the show, the people you collaborated with there.
Bruce Worrell, with the RDP, was really like my right hand. He was, you know, we decided what we wanted. We didn't want greens. We didn't want it to look like it was a suburb with a nice lawn. We had to pull the green out of everything so we could get a really faded kind of realistic look to it. He had done years ago a series that was shot out there as well called Dead Man's Gun, which photographically, cinematographically was a really exciting series. I remembered it. And then he, you know, you end up on shows that aren't particularly demanding. And I think he really wanted to do something, and I really wanted him to do something. So he was really the close guy. He was really the beginning of the look for me, because I didn't have a setting director. It was me and him. And then wardrobe, Bev Wauchuk, who basically, you know, provides the wardrobe, rents the wardrobe, or does the wardrobe for all of the Westerns. And we had a great time. We were, you know, there were poison dresses, you know, mm-hmm. the dyes that they were using in dresses and in shoes and so on that were killing people and stuff. You know, I mean, it was just that kind of thing, the care and feeling and understanding and that they put into everything that they did. You know, it's like this effect of, you know, this constant, wonderful creative thing. So
you clearly, you've talked about the pictures and you know, visual references and film references. You're clearly somebody who likes your research. Is there something that you discovered in the course of prepping or researching for the show that you haven't been able to get into the show yet?
The poison dress.
Real, the poison
year.
Dress,
yeah.
Really.
Yeah, it's next year.
Yeah, that does sound, that sounds, that's
really
great
good.
Season two.
Yeah.
The dress is killing you. You know, we sometimes in this country, I think, with our history, we tend to think, you know, as a people, we always sort of prioritize the lives that we've lived, thinking that nobody went through it before. So we kind of think that multiculturalism is something that started with Trudeau in this country and encouraging that. But one of the other things I read in one of the interviews that you did about this show was talking about Canada. You know, this is 1869, is 2 years after Canada. You're set in a place that isn't even Canada yet. But yet there is this incredible clash of cultures that goes so far beyond what we've been taught, which was the English-French dichotomy. How does that imbue into the show? How does that sort of bubble around what you did?
It just is what it was. I mean, there's so much ideology around history, and when you look at that area, that border didn't exist. 1867, it existed as a figment in Sir John A. Macdonald's mind. It didn't exist in any physical way. And the Métis and First Nations people who inhabited that area, the plains and the southern plains in what is the United States, had traveled north-south constantly. East-west was not a route. It was north-south, north-south, north-south. And everybody had their area. The Sioux were over here, and, you know, the Blackfoot and the Cree were over here. But people, the First Nations peoples, were being pushed further and further west. by a line in the States and in Canada that that squeezed them out. And you know, you look at Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee.
Yeah.
Several other books, James Dowchuk's Clearing the Plains, which was published a couple of years ago, Joseph Boyden's books. And you see this whole other history that really, really haven't told. I mean, we've told the friggin' railway story so many times. It's like crammed down your throat.
Yeah.
You know, the Blackfoot got their name because the railway ran across, you know, because of the prairie fires.
Right,
and a lot of the prairie fires were caused, you know, subsequent to the railway by the railways themselves.
Right.
I mean, terrible, terrible conflagrations that burnt out towns, and we don't tell those stories.
No.
And it's, I mean, I think it's kind of the time to do that because we have, you know, we have the Joseph Boydens now.
Yeah.
And we have Richard Wagamese. We have all of these really great First Nations, and Cliff Cardinal, a playwright. Really great First Nations writers who have these incredible stories to tell, and so, you know. And also we have this relationship with the United States that we were actually much more lawless than they were down in the States. We didn't have the Northwest Mounted Police out there until, you know, 1874, and there were like four of them.
Yeah.
So it's...
Well, see, that's what I love about it, too. It's like,
yeah.
it really does, it's just, you know, it's a tragedy of our history here that, you know, that I haven't read that in a lot of places. And that's the, you know, that's an incredible thing to think about, is that, you know, the stereotype was not true. We were the lawless ones. Like, you know, your sheriff, Tama Pennicott, coming up from, there's at least some organization down there, and there's nothing in the world of Janestown. Which I find, which runs completely counter to the narrative we've all been taught.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it's crazy, actually. And we don't know the story. We have one story about the Chinese.
Yeah.
We decided first thing when I was begging Terry Chen to come and play this role, I said, "There's no laundry in Janestown. There isn't one."
Right.
This guy's a cowboy. He's there to build an empire.
I am consistently impressed by the number of different ways that Terry Chen finds to be a badass. And, you know, he's truly, it's, you know, got an amazing ensemble there. Well, okay, so we've talked about, so I hope you're all, you know, filling your notebooks with all the literary references and all the homework that you get to go home and do now to sort of see what goes into the world of Strange Empire. But for now, why don't we take the break and let's screen the episode. Do you want to set up this episode at all? For people listening at home, I guess this podcast should be considered to have spoilers up until episode 7, because we're going to screen the 7th episode of the first season right now. Do you want to set this episode up for us?
Thomas is sick. Thomas has he has a gangrenous leg, and... Yeah, that's what happened. That's where it starts, kind of. I'm not going to... Yeah, we'll see.
That sounds good.
He's got a bad leg.
Starts in gangrene.
I'm
going to guess at some point it ends in blood. Anyway, so why don't we take the moment and we'll screen and we'll come back and we'll continue our conversation with Laurie. So let's see. Do you just sort of, wake up on a Saturday morning... Put on the kettle, make a pot of tea, say to yourself, now I'm going to read about amputation. Is that how that works? That was a particularly brutal scene.
Yeah, but, you know, you don't want to gloss it up. You know, and we took a lot out, too.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
How many times, different ways did you try that scene? Was there more? Was it more brutal?
It was more brutal. We ended up actually putting music on it and pulling a lot of the sound effects, the sawing and stuff out. Mm-hmm. It was my co-show gal, the other writer Jackie May did a series in the Children's Hospital years ago called Little Miracles.
Mm-hmm.
So she's been in operating theaters quite a bit, and she knows quite a bit about medical stuff, and so it was pretty realistic, and we wanted people to really feel what it was like. So, yeah.
Can you track a little bit for us? How did this particular episode that we watched, episode 7 now, did it change at all? Like, is that pretty much your first conception of it? What changed as you went along? Anything?
No, not much in this one, because this was really the end of the arc for Rebecca and Thomas, and I always knew where that story was going. We were a little confused, or not confused, a little fuzzy on where the reveal of Morgan was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the place to do it.
Mm-hmm. How much of the arcs for the first season did you have worked out from the beginning? And are you one of those writers? Do you start from the end and work backwards?
I knew the end. Yeah, I knew the end all along. And it changed, but it didn't change in a profound way. It just flipped.
Mm-hmm.
It was a really. I always saw the end. I always knew the end. It's the middle that's the tricky part, as you know.
Yeah, the middle is the tricky part. Now, what were the things that you discovered, without, I guess, spoiling too much, but as you go along, did you find you had to speed up certain sequences? Were there things that didn't have as much meat on them as you thought? Were there more subplots that needed to be developed? What did you find the particular challenge of breaking this middle part of the season, because middles are incredibly hard.
Yeah, they are incredibly hard. I mean, we always had so much material. It was really trying to figure out where it was going to go in. It's really tricky to find the thematic for the episode. You know, mm-hmm. is to figure out how it hangs together as an episode. That's always the problem. There's a scene in here that's way too long. It's the scene between Rebecca and Franklin Case when she asks him to cut off Thomas's leg to help her out. That's way too long, that scene. But I love the lilt and the tone of Teach's voice, you mm-hmm. know. And it was just, and I felt like I had, you know, I had some rope there, because it's really an ensemble piece, and you want to feel these characters and see where they're coming from and get into them a little bit more. So I did get a note that it was too long, and I agreed with the note, but mm-hmm. I didn't cut it. So
there you go. So tell me about the collaboration on the series and I guess where you're the first one up with, for lack of a better phrase, new CBC. Where, you know, now CBC decides we're gonna swing for something different. We're not gonna do popular. We're gonna do something that's more curated, I guess, more public broadcaster worthy. So, what was the notes process like for this show?
The notes were great. I mean, it really was very collaborative. They really left us alone. I mean, I work with our exec is Katrina Onstad, who's a novelist as well. So I would advise you to have an exec who's a novelist. because she was incredibly helpful, because mm-hmm. we were very shorthanded, and we got actually great notes. We got really helpful notes. The other exec producer, Jeff Sagansky, was a network executive as well, was the president of a couple of networks. And he's brought about 200 television series into the world, and he has an extraordinary sense of story. Very, you know, his notes generally were 3 minutes long, and that you would go, oh my God, he just saw right through that. Mm-hmm. You know, you painted yourself into a corner, you couldn't figure your way out, you were tired, you're exhausted. And you'd get his phone call, and it was clarified. And the same I would say with Katrina.
Can you point to a specific piece of feedback they gave that made you change direction or solved a problem that you didn't know you had?
Yeah, I had one that I didn't agree with at all, because the real trick in this show is finding something light and without selling out the show.
Mm-hmm.
And I had in episode 5, which is the marriage episode, which I had been dying to write ever since I first started the show and had like 15 minutes to write when push came to shove, I had a light little piece in there that was a very Midsummer Night's Dream with two bounty hunters who come after Kat. Tantu Cardinal's in the episode, and she plays this kind of weird medicine woman, and she's trying to... Kat's looking for Jeremiah still, and she can't find him, and these bounty hunters turn up, and the girls, Kelly and Robin, need to get them out of the picture. And I did a kind of little playful thing where they ate magic mushrooms, and the bounty hunters turned and looked at each other and, you know, skimmed some dialogue from Midsummer Night's Dream about your freckles are like jewels and the moon and the stars are in your eyes and why haven't I seen this before, and they walk off together with their horses. And it was really absolutely lovely, lovely, lovely thing. But it's different, you know. It's the journey of trying to find what's going to work as something light in a show like this. Where do you go with it? And that's still, you know, a big question for me. It's how to find that stuff that people that isn't sentimental and gooey and syrupy, because I just can't deal with that. I can't stand it. Mm-hmm. I cut a lot of stuff out of the scene with Jim Burns at the end giving the watch, because it just got really, really too, you know. So the light stuff is really hard in this. It's really, really hard.
Do you find, is it just the nature of the project, or is that something that you think, is that the most difficult part of your wheelhouse, trying to find the light in the
Yeah, dark? It is. But I mean, I've written a novel, and which is still in the drawer. No fear. But the light for me, the light stuff always comes in a kind of magical, funny, strange kind of way. A sprightliness, I would say. I mean, Maddie, the little girl, the little redheaded girl in Durham County. She brought that, but it's because she's strange and she sees things, and Robin is kind of like that a little bit too. That sort of character is definitely in my head when I write.
It's interesting. I was a huge fan of Durham County. I think we've talked about this before. I just really loved that show when it first came out, and I remember I look at this and I see a line. And it's funny that, of course, it's a period piece in the past, because I really do see a line from Durham County through to this show. Do you, as a writer, do you see that? Do you think that there are certain subjects that you keep returning to, that you're attracted to, do you see the commonality between the two?
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
Where do they exist? Where does that exist to you?
In the way that you draw a hero. Like Durham, they're really the same guy. It's like the doppelganger. There's a sort of schizoid characterization between those two guys, and they blur. And here, just pulling apart the character of Slaughter, it's very much like the same concerns are there that were there with Ray and Mike and Durham. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What do you What is your? I'm fascinated. I'm always fascinated. This is the part where it's like, you know, the mining the process question. How do you like to work? Are you a morning writer? Are you an evening writer? Tell me about what's your writing day like. How do you like to work?
I'm a very organized person. I don't believe in chaos. I get up at the first thing in the morning, and it's like going to the office. Mm-hmm. I get up. I get dressed. I decide what we're having for dinner, you know, make sure it's in the fridge, sit down, start to work. Right. And I work usually until lunch, and then I'm too tired to work, or I read, or I have a nap or something like that. And then if I'm really on a deadline or something, I go back to it about 4 o'clock, and I can have a little sort of spurt of intelligent writing for an hour or so, and that's the end of it.
Mm-hmm. Do you like to work off detailed outlines?
To some degree. I mean, I like a spine in a scene. I like to, there's a big exploratory part of of a story for me, trying to figure out where what I'm trying to say, what's interesting here, what can be mined here, what the what's going on between these characters that we haven't seen yet, we haven't uncovered yet. So mm-hmm. there's a lot of yak and talk about that. And then finding some interesting beats that you wouldn't have seen before, and finding the ever precious Act Four reversal, the really great beat that nobody's expecting. Mm-hmm. I really feel action is really important, and I don't think there's, you know, characters are action, and I love Elmore Leonard because stuff moves. And I think it's really important for stuff to move, and characters do that. They choose what to do, and they choose how what action to take. And so yeah, I always try to do that. I always try to find a line right through a story.
Right. What's there's a couple of interviews that I read in prepping for this that you talk about. Various conventions. So let's talk a little bit about conventions now. Some of the things that you see in television that exist on the air today, you know, A and B plots, closed and open stories, cliffhangers, the role of the hero, the role of the villain. What of the tropes of writing television are you fond of, and which ones do you want to push off the cliff? What are the ones that you're just tired of?
I'm just tired if the work isn't done. I mean, there's some stuff. There's stuff that's really funny. There are great, really wonderful, funny writers who do shows that are fairly conventional. Mm-hmm. I just want to do something different always. I always want to do something I haven't done before or something I haven't seen before. So,
can we go back a little bit and sort of, because there's always a component of the people that are listening to these podcasts and coming out to these events that are, you know, people that are, there's an aspirational aspect to it. Do you want to talk a little bit about how the 30-second version of how you got your start, how you got into writing, and you know, what your first break was and all
yeah,
that sort of
I mean,
stuff?
I worked for a guy, an incredibly wealthy guy, who producer from France, Samuel Hadida, who made all sorts of really wild movies. He made Silent Hill, is what he's doing right now. Perfume, and he did a lot of B movies. And he and I started working together, and he would sort of shoot me all of this stuff that these B movies that he was doing in Los Angeles and Japan. And so I did a rewrite on a thing, an anime, which was live action anime, beautifully shot movie called Crying Freeman. And it's a terrible, sentimental, saccharine mm-hmm. piece of, you know, but it was beautiful. And we blew up three limousines in front of the Vancouver Art Gallery, and that was normal. And,
right.
And then, you know, and I would get paid fairly well for, you know, taking a week to write to change a part from a man to a woman in a particular script. Roger Avery, I was rewriting Roger Avery, which was mm-hmm. kind of fun. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, it was just a job, and I got really tired of writing these action sequences where 377 people died in the course of a movie in an interesting way. I just got really bored with it.
Right, the deaths were interesting, yeah. The characters weren't.
Yeah, well, I mean, the characters weren't. And it would just got, it was the same task over and over again. It was like working at the bank, you know? Mm-hmm. And it was fun. And then Julia Keatley and Anne-Marie LaTraverse brought Cold Squad, the first season of Cold Squad, and I fell in love with the show because I thought it was so interesting. Nobody had done anything like that before, and it was all about the past and all about these victims and all about, you know, that this world that had never really been tapped before. So that's what I did. I did that for a couple of years.
It's one of these things that's always interesting. This verges into personality journalism, but One of the things that strikes me as interesting about you, the times I've met you, is that you are very personable, very, you know, erudite. You're always talking about a book. You're always doing the, and then you sit down and you write this stuff, and it comes out so dark. Where does that? I mean, is it just that's what you're attracted to? Is it just that you think is that something that you explore? Is it you know, life isn't dark, so you get to get that out of your art. Is it a misnomer to say that you've got a dark sensibility? I mean,
no, I mean, life is dark. I mean, there are terrible things that happen to people, and I like to give, you know, credence to that. I think that's where we're most interestingly human, when you know, we take seriously the terrible things that happen to us and to other people. And I think it makes us better people.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really interested in the processes by which personally, culturally, historically, we deny things.
Mm.
We refuse to see, we fantasize, we make what is something that we don't see. And that's always, I've always second-guessed myself, you know, why are you doing this? You know, what are you really thinking? And that kind of stuff. So...
When you look back on your career now, is there what's the best piece of writing advice that you ever got? And if you had the chance to go back and give your 15 years ago self a piece of writing advice, what would it be?
That there's no difference between character and action.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Francine Prose. Yeah.
Right. Okay, so now this is a question. Here's one that I struggled with. As approaching this sort of thing, because of, you know, a lot of what I do in the WGC, not a lot of what, but the WGC is concerned. Of course, we you know, we have diversity programs and we have all this sort of stuff. And there's lots of studies that have come out about recently in the last year about representation and you know, women in the film and television business and why they're lagging behind. And so I feel like I need to ask a gender question, but I have spent 3 days throwing up my hands at this, just at a loss, because I feel like every time it gets discussed, every article it gets discussed in, the same things get said. It's all platitudes, and we never come closer to a solution. And we hear Jill Golic laughing in the audience here, because, you know, Jill chaired a panel at the World Conference of Screenwriters, and now suddenly, you know, she's getting phone calls left and right as the women's expert. And I have the situation of a lot of my female writer friends who, you know, every time they go out, they interview for the woman in the room. And it just is so awful. And here you are on a show that, you know, your producers are women. You had lots of female directors. You have network executives that are women. And, I mean... is there something to be learned from the experience? Was it different in any way? Is there something carrying forward that you think that we're overcomplicating this, that the industry just needs to step up? Do you have any thoughts on that?
No, to me it's just normal. I mean, all the best working experiences that I've had have been with both men and women. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, there's been in the shows in Durham and in this one, Strange Empire, the execs have been women, and I think, you know, I think that's just what it is.
Yeah.
I mean, we have a club, you know, we one woman in the rooms, we're the Wendy's.
Yeah.
And,
well, it's funny.
And I don't know that it's us that have to think about it so much as you know. The guides in the room. I mean, I'm not drawing lines, and everybody points at me too and says, you know, you're all about women. Why is this about women? And so it's kind of, they're interesting, aren't they?
They're way more interesting. I'm constantly telling my wife, it's like, you know, it's like, please don't make the mistake of thinking I'm as complicated as you are. I'm not. You know, I mean, you know, I think men frequently are binary. You know, we're on, off.
But I also think that the fluidity is really interesting, because mm-hmm. I think that, you know, there are you know, to say, I don't want to sound new age here, because I don't have really an iota of that in me, but there are male energies and female energies, and I think female and masculine, male, feminine and masculine. And in the scene that we just saw between Thomas and Rebecca, where he gives her her profession.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, fathers are really important yeah. to women, and he blesses her. He blesses her and gives her a chance to stand for herself. I mean, if you have a father that does that as a young woman, that makes all the difference in the world. Mm-hmm. All the difference in the world. So,
and the thing that frustrates me about, you know, this continuing problem in our industry. Again, at this conference that just finished in Poland, there was a panel where the question came up, and you know, by chance, Tom Fontana and a couple of the people on the panel all talked about how the latest shows they were on, they had rooms, and there was parity in the rooms. It was 50-50. It wasn't there was one woman in the room. It mm-hmm. was there was half women and half men. And universally, that's a better experience. And yeah. I am amazed always when I'm working with, it's just, you just come at it differently. I love the experience of being able to turn over story and watching someone come up with something and just come at it from the other way and just, we never would have gotten there if I had to think on it my own. And I don't know why we have such trouble translating that to a representational thing that reflects not only, you know, the population, but also reflects the people that are watching television. It's 50, you know, the television audience is 53% female now.
There are a lot of women, I mean, in right now running shows.
Yeah.
Morwen Rebner at
yep.
Saving Hope.
Dagan's running.
Dagan Bitten. And Bitten yep. and Lost Girl.
Yep.
I mean, I don't, you know, they've got those rooms. Orange is the New Black.
Yeah.
You know, there are a lot of women in the States running shows too.
Mm-hmm.
So if we just accept that and look at it and
we
say
just have to keep bashing at it, yeah?
Yeah, I don't feel like I'm bashing at it. It yeah. feels pretty normal to me.
Okay.
Yeah.
A couple of more things and then I'm going to open it up to questions from the audience here. So if you're burning to ask something, get ready for it because we're coming to it. So I asked the notes. Oh, look at this. What are you not good at that you wish you were?
Numbers.
Numbers?
Oh, I'm so bad at numbers. I know the word enumerate.
Right.
Which is good. So, and I can add and subtract. And percentages are difficult, especially if it's a really good thing that you really want to buy and would look nice in your closet.
Mm-hmm,
and
yeah.
You know, I'm really bad at numbers. Really bad at numbers.
I think that tends to be a not uncommon complaint of our ilk, I believe.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What, if any, is there? Do you have a? This is terrible because it's a choose your favorite, choose your darlings question. But do you have a moment from the first season that you particularly look at and go, that nailed it. That is what I wanted to do. That was really special. I'm very proud of that.
No, I have all sorts of moments.
Mm-hmm. What are
like
some
that.
Of them?
Well, they're coming up.
Oh, okay. Oh,
yeah.
Well, let's
yeah.
not do that then.
Yeah.
Let's not do that. So so we finish strong, do we?
Yes, I think so.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I'm glad
yeah.
to hear that.
Yeah.
All right. So why don't we, you know what, I might ask a couple more as we go along, but for now, you've all been sitting here patiently, so why don't we get the microphones going and...
Is that Anne? That's Anne. There's Anne Wheeler's in our audience
oh,
tonight,
great.
The director
oh, terrific.
Of this episode.
Okay. So why don't we go to... Let's get a microphone to Anne, but let's go to Jill first for the question.
Hi, Laurie. I wanted to ask about how... Like, you talked about how you had done written a novel, and I'm just interested in how you know a story is going to make an arced TV series, that it's right for television as opposed to a novel, because, I mean, we've been used to writing so many shows that are very episodic in nature and, you know, finding concepts that will generate a million shows. But what makes a show, an arced show, a show? And how do you shape an episode of it?
I don't know. I mean, I was never good at single episodic stuff. I think, you know, I worked on Cold Squad, which was crime of the week kind of thing. I did an episode of Cracked, but it was an episode which would have been a movie that I would have liked to have done. And Bruce had to trim it back, I'm sure, quite a bit. But I have big stories, you know. I like Russian novels. I like, you know, I like epic. I like to see a whole full world, and the only way that you can really do that is like this. So, yeah.
Great question. We have somebody there in the row.
Hi, Lori. Great show. I just wanted to ask where the title came from.
Yeah, it's actually a book. It's Joseph Kinsey Howard, who was a great friend. He was a writer. He wrote for Saturday Night and The New Yorker. American guy, lived in Montana. Friend, I believe, of Wallace Stegner, that whole group of writers in and around that area. He was a friend of the Métis, and he basically wanted to tell the story of the Indian Wars. That's how he put it. He wrote the book, I think, in 1954, and it wasn't quite finished when he died. But it basically tells the story that Dee Brown went on to tell at Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, the story from the First Nations side of things. And the Métis, again, are not quite First Nations. They're European, white, Scots, usually French, mix. And their journey to prove that they were a people unto themselves. So that's. I haven't actually finished reading his book. I have it at home. It was when we were trying to figure, because the first title for the series was Janestown, and nobody liked that. So Sally Cato and I were on the phone one day, and I was staring around at all the books on my shelves, and I said, okay, how about Strange Empire? And she loved that, and she went to town with that, and I hated it. And now I love it, so we're all fine.
Can we talk a little bit more about that? How hard are titles?
Ugh.
Are they not the and I happen to be on the other CBC show coming up. Oh, the problems with titles and trying to come up with them, and, you know, 15 different suggestions, and then your second 15 suggestions, and you always hate them, and you try to learn to love with it. I don't know why they're so difficult, but
because
they
take
are.
Over your mind. They're like a terrible fungus that just eats through every single cell, and that's all you can think of is the title. You can't think of the arc or the character or the episode you're supposed to be writing or the deadline you have. All you can think of is the title until you get it.
It's true. Yeah. It's weird. It's like an infection.
Yeah.
It's a contagion. Yeah. And the thing about it is that when it spreads to other people too, like we were in production.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you know, you're sitting there and you've got all this stuff to do, but literally you are spending a half hour when you have nine things to do writing stupid titles, looking through thesauruses, looking on your bookshelf to try to come up with something.
Yeah.
It's horrible.
Yeah.
It's horrible. Life's such first world problems. Why don't we go down here to the corner? Oh no, I'm sorry, we got somebody else? Oh, somebody. Okay, why don't you guys just pick who's gonna go? I'm superfluous now.
Hi, Larry. My question was: we've seen sort of the rise and fall of various kinds of genres in TV and books and such. You know, the vampire genre and so on and so forth. So the Western genre is one that has really sort of endeared for a long time, but has really had a lot of hits and misses. Strange Empire has been a really great revival of that. So how do you sell this? How do you make this new? How do you bring the Western back, if there is a way at all to do that?
Because I think the Western has always been about something, you know, and when it's not about something, it fails. It was about America, and it was about, you know, being American. It was it had a lot of truck because of that. But I mean, the last one that was done, the movie with the Tonto, what was it, the Lone Ranger?
Lone Ranger.
Yeah, with Johnny Depp. It was a failure, I think. I haven't seen it, but what I read about it, because it wasn't really engaging. It was more camp. It was more it wasn't working. But this, I think it engages because I think it relates to, you know, a history that hasn't been told on this side of the line, and a First Nations history that hasn't been told, an ethnic histories that haven't really been touched on. People are seeing themselves in the show. It's transparent in the sense of it's not a show about a black woman or a Chinese woman. Everybody's there, so it kind of looks like walking down the street or looking into this audience. And I really like that the ethnicities are transparent and we're just telling stories. I think that's what makes it more relevant. I loved Deadwood. I thought Deadwood was, but I got really tired of the blowjob soliloquies. I really got fed up with that. So, but it was a kind of a goose to, you know, tell it from the other side of the track.
But see, the amazing thing about it is, I had the same reaction with Deadwood too. It's like, and Unforgiven. Unforgiven came out, and I thought, well, that's it for the Western. And Deadwood came out, and I thought, oh, now that's really it for the Western. The interesting thing about Strange Empire is not just that you've reinvented it, but that what you see is there are so many stories in the Western that have just never been told.
Yeah, I don't think I'm not going to say I reinvented it. I won't take that on. The one that I really went back to was McCabe and Mrs. Miller, Robert Altman. That to me was an incredibly fully thought out and fully realized story. It said everything that there was to say in itself there.
It's amazing that you say that, because I hadn't even thought about that till mm-hmm. you mentioned it the first time, and mm-hmm. it is very true. If you haven't seen McCabe and Mrs. Miller, that's a great show. Why don't we take another... we'll go down in front now.
Hi. Congratulations on the show. It's inspirational. It's moving. It's taking Canadian television in a whole new direction. That's really exciting. And I wanted to go back to... I heard an interview with you on The Current, mm-hmm. and you were talking about that if you didn't make this as a series, it would have been a novel. And so it's kind of going back to the question Joel was asking. But I wanted to know, how would you have done it differently? Like, is it more open-ended doing it as a series? Because it could go on for 5 or 6 seasons.
It's not actually open ended, because I had planned it as basically the 15 years that Louis Riel spent between Red River and Montana, looking at Kat basically as his niece, you know, and that was the time period for the story. If it was a novel, I don't think it's really that much different. I mean, it's a different process, but the story would have been much the same. If it was a novel, it would take a lot longer and probably wouldn't get done. But television is really wonderful, because it gets up there and people talk to you about it, and you have this wonderful experience of other people inside your head. And it feels like a real kind of a communication. It's really quite nice. I don't know that authors, when they go around signing their books all across the country, and, you know, have the same kind of... I suppose they do when they find a real fan, a real great fan. But television is wonderful like that, because everybody gets on the bus. Everybody has a sense of what you're doing, and it's very rewarding that way.
Do you prefer screenwriting to prose writing?
I miss language. Not so much in this one, because there's all sorts of fun to be had in the dialogue here. But in Durham, I missed language. When I write prose, I love the language. I would really urge you, actually, to go to the digital on this, Rebecca's Curiosities at the cbc.ca site, because we have a wonderful writer, playwright, Amy Lee Lavoie, who has done the digital, the writing on the digital, and she did it in conjunction with Melissa Farman. Melissa didn't write, but Amy really got into Rebecca's character with Melissa, and it's absolutely beautiful, stunningly beautiful writing, language, and picture. The digital that goes with it is wonderful. So,
Fantastic. So check that out on cbc.ca. Do we have, we're going to go somewhere here, or we want on the side? We have one right down in front here. So we want to run that mic there.
Hi, thanks, Lori, for showing us the new episode. My question is about the actors. So how is it to write these roles and to have other people come in and interpret them? Does it make you see the characters differently, or is it more as you expected it to be?
It depends. I mean, you have... I love working with actors because they generally like working with me. You do explore the character. You see the character as it's embodied by the actor, and you have you start to write in a slightly different way. Some actors are you get an emotional kind of a connection from them. You see the way that they relate to each other. You discover things in their relationship that there's not the just the relationship that they have as people that are coming from the characterization, and I always find that kind of interesting. I believe we have Joanne here tonight, right? Is she up there? There she is. Joanne Boland, who plays Morgan, is up there. So she's sinking in her seat. I won't point her out, but she did a wonderful job with Morgan. That was a tough one. How many of you realized that Morgan was a woman? Good Lord, we've got the smart people here tonight. Okay.
I was three episodes in. I was pretty tired. But it was like, episode three, I was like, wait a second.
It was a good beard, though, in this episode.
You know what?
On a big screen, you see the beard.
It was pretty well done, man. That really worked. The fact that Joanne's sinking down in the seat, does that mean could we ask you a question? Would you be willing? So, just because I think it's wonderful to hear the other side of it, can you talk a little bit about the collaboration that you had in terms of any conversations you might have had with Lori? And how you bring to life that character? It's a very understated performance, and like I said, it's a really nice piece of work. There's great acting all the way through that. What was your process back and forth?
Well, it was an interesting one for me because it was a pretty quick turnaround from when I auditioned, because I self-taped for this role, and so what had come across to me was just really a couple of lines, a description about Morgan. So I actually didn't have a lot in terms of when I was auditioning to play Morgan. But it was one of those, as soon as I got the sides, it was just one of the most, just felt just ease getting into it. It just felt one of the fastest preps for me ever in terms of putting something down, because there was just such a connection with it. And then when I got Morgan, it was truly, I think I got my offer on the Friday, and I had to be in Vancouver for Tuesday for our table read for the show. And it was probably one of the most amazing experiences of my life, of truly looking around the room and seeing these characters come to life. And Laurie's just phenomenal to work with. What I loved about working with Lori is the sense of trust in the people in which she's collaborated with, in which she's chosen to work with, and you feel that freedom. And because of that, what you were talking about earlier, with you and Slaughter and Aaron, and you feel that, and you just feel that there's this safe place to work. And it was really interesting in terms of, through the season, developing Morgan, and it was one of the best experiences of my life.
The wardrobe was interesting, though. That transformation to...
Absolutely.
Wasn't that? That was like
it
this
was,
little
yeah.
weird sort of tunnel transformation kind of weird thing. It was...
Yeah.
And we never really knew where you were going.
No.
It was an interesting experience of fluidity, because, gender these days is so marked and tagged and so political, and I really felt Morgan I wanted him to be very fluid. Mm. I wanted Rebecca to be somebody who, because she was an autistic savant, just responded straightforwardly, desiring this person in that moment and wanting that person without that desire being shaped in any way. I wanted to feel that fluidity and see it. So in the very first episode, when she's got her jacket off and she's in her corset and Morgan goes by on his horse, and she feels, because she feels this physiological... You know, she has a little trill of desire that she's never really felt before. And we actually got that on camera. And I kind of thought, okay, well, now I've done everything that I ever wanted to do on screen. I got that down. We're not, you know. So working that relationship between the two of them was a lot of fun.
There's probably a dozen different things I could point to just from having devoured this series over the last few weeks. But two of them would be, again, there was another article that was written that somebody else wrote about Rebecca. And the interesting thing is, I mean, we've seen a lot of, you know, people in the Asperger's spectrum and autism portrayed on screen in the last little while. But this one person was writing, but we hadn't seen that they're usually portrayed as sexless. And that there's the melding of that gave an element to it that I've never seen before. We've also seen the undercover performer, the person, you know, who's hiding their her gender. But Morgan is different than I've never seen it done that way before. Does that come from your keyboard? Does it come from that ether space in between in the collaboration? Where, I mean, is that what you strive for, to take these tropes and just do them in a way that you haven't seen before? Is that important to you?
No, it's not. It's not just that. I mean, I'm really interested in the way that female desire is shaped. Mm. I mean, I have all of these books about, you know, Victorian catalogs,
right?
Which basically, women started to admire themselves and each other because of the way that the photographs were taken of the dresses and so on and so forth. Right. And I there were a lot of women who went around dressed, in particularly in the West, who went around dressed as men because it was safer. Mm-hmm. And they weren't really seen through in the way that we might see through them now. So it, to me, it's something that I want to explore that. I find that really, really fascinating. I find it, you know, what are we like as desiring animals, you know, and what is it? Because, you know, that's the thing that really, you know, makes us do things, good and bad, terrible things, certainly in our 20s.
Yes.
And but I was just really interested in it because it is so shaped. And now, too, you know, young women are so sexualized, so hypersexualized, that it's like, oh, God, leave me alone. It's too much, you know. You don't have a chance to kind of figure it out for yourself.
Yeah. The 20s, the strange empire for everyone. we have another question here. We have one right dead center in the middle. Can we send the microphone down there?
Thank you. Hello.
Hi.
Thank you for the show. It was great to discover it. I have not seen the other episodes on TV yet, so I got the spoiler right in my face.
Yeah.
You spoke about the digital component. Can you elaborate a little bit on how it was created, what kind of responsibility you have on it, how you conceptualized it?
Yeah, it's the company that did it is Switch United in Vancouver, and I wanted to do something that would just be like every book that I ever wanted to read or see, every picture, every strange, weird thing. And gave them really a free hand to do. I showed them the Wisconsin Death Trip pictures, the interest in photography, a book about curiosity cabinets, an Italian woman who was an anatomist and who built all these models out of wax in the 15th century, you know, like little eyeballs that had been. It's just like all of these really fascinating historical pieces, and what Rebecca, you know, as a young girl in a sanitarium in Quebec in the mid 19th century would be thinking about, and what her consciousness would be, and to try to really just get into that so we could understand her, because she's kind of the least accessible of all of the characters, and I wanted people to have an experience of her, what was going on in her mind. It's very kind of pretty similar to what goes on in mine, what's in there. But it is beautifully rendered. The images in there, the movement in there, the language, Amy's language. I really urge you to go see it. It's really a nice piece of work.
Amazing. Thanks for the question. Do we have someone else? Another one?
Surely there must be a couple of more.
Our director's here, Anne. I see you sinking into your chair there. But probably this was her episode 7, and also episodes 11, 10 and 11, which are just absolutely extraordinarily beautiful, beautiful episodes. So thank you, Anne.
Can we get Anne a mic?
Do you want to speak, Anne, or do you want to just...
Can we ask you a question about... I'm fascinated by, obviously, you know, the amazing thing about television production, the reason why I like it, and I think clearly from what you've said tonight, there is this amazing thing that there are a key 40 people, any one of which can just tip you over into making a terrible show. And it's a high wire act. And yet, there's the other part of that is that the collaboration through all these people bringing their gifts and their different perspectives, when it works and when it clicks, there's no better drug in the world than being able to make this thing together. So how did you approach these scripts? When you got these in your hot little hands, what was your reaction to them? What was your first reaction, and how did you approach bringing them?
Well, luckily, I was interviewed sometime back in May, and when I read the first script, I just felt hungry to do it. It's a women's history in Canada. I mean, I think my first documentary in 1972 was called Great Grandmother, set in the 19th century, all based on diaries and letters. So this was I just was so excited that it was going to be made, just was hoping that I'd get one or two, delighted that I got three, because I wasn't involved in the very first episodes, it was cast by the time I came on, but I was involved in casting some of the smaller parts, and then you get to be on set when it's actually happening, so you're sort of adding the salt and pepper and the spices and just keep it as tasty as you can get it, and Lori and Jackie were always just a very short distance away, you know.
Annoyingly so at times.
Well, really, I mean, you weren't on set that much, but we always knew that you were, I mean, they were madly writing their, continuing to write as we were shooting, and we only had I guess for this episode was 6.5, almost 7 days to shoot. So, everybody is really passionately trying to make this as wonderful as we can make it, because the spirit on set was extraordinary. We were all very excited about what we were watching, just as the first audience. Your crew is your first audience, right? And you could just see them getting, this is something, we're doing something really, really, we're going to love, we're going to be proud of, we're hoping it makes it, it becomes part of your own spirit. So you just get on board, and 100 people or so are just doing everything they can to make it as good as they can make it.
There is that word. There's a word, sticky, right? When things are sticky, and this show is very sticky in the sense that I know there have been at least a couple of times when stumbling around at 3 o'clock in the morning, going to the bathroom after watching a couple of episodes before I went to bed. There's been a couple of times where I've sat up in my office and just sort of thunk on it a little bit. And I ain't doing that with NCIS,
as a director, too, you have a hard time going to sleep when you get home, right? You know that you've got another 12-hour day coming tomorrow, but you've got home and you've just been in this room where this woman's cut this man's leg off, and as she said, there was a bit more gore than ended up in the...
That was not an easy thing to do. I mean, we had to cut a table, and our actor had two hip replacements, so it wasn't like very easy to lie him down for 3.5-4 hours.
Yeah. So, yeah, and it was just emotionally, a great expenditure, too. So you get home and you go out in the backyard and look at the stars for a while and keep telling yourself you better get some sleep because tomorrow's coming up pretty soon.
But there's something I want to point out there, too, that a little writing thing that I think is great in that episode. The scene before it where Morgan and Rebecca, where she's showing her how to saw through the wood. That's great writing and it's great conception because you sit there, you know what's coming, and you just sit there and it's all in front of you. You're like, oh my God, this is going to be horrible. This is going to be the worst thing ever. And the fact that she can't do it, you just like it. The tension that gets ratcheted up by that earlier scene, by the time you come to the amputation scene, makes it almost unbearable. You don't need the gore because you've already created in the audience's mind how horrible this is going to be, which is, well done.
Yeah, but I was thinking, the only reason Jackie May knows how to do this is because she does winter camping, which I could never understand. Why the hell you want to go up a mountain in the middle of the winter and saw wood? But she could saw wood. I mean, she knew what she was talking about. Wasn't my line of dialogue.
I don't even understand camping. If there's not room service, that's roughing it. Let's go down here. Oh, thank you. Thanks very much, Anne. This is great. We get to hear from everybody today. We have actors, and we have directors, and we have writers, and it's all about the great show. Thank you.
Hi, Dennis Laurie. Just wondering, especially with only two of you writing all 13 episodes, can you talk about just how you juggled all that writing with the show running responsibilities? And also, like, did you enjoy all that other side of it? Coming at this originally as a writer and involved in all the other aspects.
We had other writers, Layla Basin and Penny Gummerson. We didn't have much of a room. We only had two weekends, two four-day weekends in September and in November last year. We did, I think, a pretty good job of breaking the story. And I think because we left things pretty wide open, that writers can get in there and work on it. This is what I want to have happen for next year, because I want many more writers on it, and I think if we break it and we get some good people, then certainly we won't be writing the way that we were writing this time. I co-wrote the last two. I was going to do the last two myself, but I co-wrote with Jackie. Jackie also wrote. She wrote this one. She wrote episode 10. And 9, too, right? She wrote your episode, Anne? I think so, yeah.
Did you ever start prep without a script?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, with scripts that were falling apart.
Right.
And that was, that's a bitch, tell you.
The great cruelty of television production. The crew can shoot faster than you can write it.
Yeah. No, but we had a lot going in. I mean, we had 9 going in various stages of things. So, there's a period where you're cocky and you think you've got it all under control, and then you realize that you don't. In 4, I suddenly realized that Kat was Métis. She wasn't First Nations, and I wasn't really representing that in the way that I needed to, her and Tomo. It got done. It did get done. I love post, and Jackie May is great on set. We ended up hiring another a young writer who was an AD and is also married to a showrunner. to work set when we couldn't work set, because I always like to have somebody there. We sent our coordinator in to work set sometimes, just mm-hmm. to be there as a resource. I did the post. I can do post really fast. I really like post. We had wonderful editors, and the stories are very well structured. So, you know, there are certain the director would go in. I don't think I changed a bloody thing in your episodes. You really, yeah.
Anne says
I fast tracked through Anne's episodes, her 9 and 10, because there was really very, very little to do for post. So that was good, because I had to write 12 and 13 with Jackie. So thank you again. but it's like a whirlwind. I mean, it's like a crazy. I've came home on the 25th of October, and I'm still exhausted. I'm absolutely exhausted. And I did a mix last night at 8 o'clock for episode 9, and I still haven't locked 12 and 13. So I'm going to be working through till, you know, the end of December. So it's an exhausting job. Think twice is what I would say. Think twice and then think again.
Be careful what you wish for, right? I think we do have a couple of other questions. I saw a flurry of other hands. We've got a microphone right there ready to go.
Strange Empire is a really diverse, wonderfully diverse show. I'm wondering if you could speak to how you make sure, when writing identities other than your own, how you make sure that you're being truthful, especially when a lot of those identities sort of overlap with stereotypes without getting trapped by them.
Well, I mean, we talk, you know. I like with Terry. I mean, that there was the promise that there would be no laundry, you know, and that we would. I wanted a Chinese cowboy, and the backstory that I had for Ling was he was the son of a royal concubine, because there were two concubines who were the empresses, Chi Chi and the other one of China at that time. There was the regent died when he was 13. So these two women were politically astute, and they ran this country. And I thought, oh, isn't that so convenient for me that this history actually happened? Because he, of course, falls in love with Isabel. And she's a madam, and she's brilliant and strategic, as was his mother. And so that was just wonderful. But I spend a lot of time talking to Terry about the Chinese and Chinese history, and he put me on to a fellow professor that he knows and has worked with, a guy in San Francisco, who's given me like a long list of books and so on. And the new work that's coming out from the First Nations writers like Joseph Boyden and Richard Wagamese and James Dachuk, the professor who wrote Clearing the Plains, the documentary book. You want to like go to those kinds of sources and try to do everything right. So, yeah.
Funny, you know, the podcast for this, if we can somehow get the annotated version with Amazon Buy Here links with everything you mentioned, we could finance your second season your associate links. Do we have somebody else down here? I thought I saw another hand. I didn't. Is that am I
We've
making that up?
We've exhausted them.
Oh, down in front here.
So, in your medical research. For the series, what was the most disturbing information you found?
Basically anything that Jackie May brought up before lunch, you know. I mean, she has all of these stories. I mean, she was there for, you know, in utero surgeries at the Children's Hospital. She has great stories about weird surgeons. If you were bleeding to death while winter camping with her, you wouldn't have a problem. She'd know what to do. So she was, and she just loves that stuff. She's just a fantastic authority for that. So, yeah. Yeah. So I wasn't actually that into the medical. I kind of let up on it because she was so good at it. I didn't really have to think about that sort of stuff. So I thought about the sex.
Good. I think we have room. We have time for a couple of other questions. If anyone else has something else they want to bring up, nobody. Oh, well, you down here?
You mentioned before about being happy that everybody gets on the bus, and it's like a shared experience. Mm-hmm. With social media and fan boards, and are you getting just way more notes from everyone rather than just, or do you just ignore that, or does it ever shape the story?
It's just started, all of that stuff, so I haven't really, you know, I got a lovely, there's a lovely tweet from Hart Hansen, who's the showrunner on Bones, and who I was his assistant years and years and years ago on a show.
Oh, wow.
called Horsemen, about cops and biker gangs. And he wrote that it was a wonderful thing that the CBC was doing, that it was strange and gothic and marvelous, and so I'm going to ask him for a job.
Good. Good plan. Anyone else? We have another one right down here. Let's give that for the microphone runners, everybody.
Yeah. I'm curious to know if there's a, seeing as how we're at the television festival here, is there another show that you would love to just write an episode for one of your friends, and why?
Anything that Karen Walton does. I love Karen Walton, and I have been trying to get her to work on a project with me for the last couple of years. We just met this afternoon. So anything she did, I would be happy to do. I love Orphan Black. I think that's a great show. I kind of like my time to myself, actually, to after a show like this, I wouldn't want to write an episode.
Great. Okay. One more question, and then we can bring it to a close. Someone must have something burning. See? You always ask. You got to let Canadians come to you.
Thank you. I'm wondering what your pitch process was like. Did you go in just as a writer? Did you bring a producer and a director on board? And did they ask for you to change anything to kind of fit what they needed?
More. No. I had two producers come to me, they brought that log line, and I checked them out, and I refused them about three or four times as that log line was sinking in, and I was trying to figure out how I could do that without involving them and still be a moral, upstanding human being. And and then they said CBC, and I really wasn't sure that I would be able to do a CBC show. So it was figuring out what the parameters were for the CBC and making a decision that regardless of what they were, I would do this, and I would just step back. If they gave me notes that pissed me off, I would just say, okay, fine, give it to somebody else. But it was an interesting enough. I mean, the nice thing about being a writer is you can do these really great projects and have all this. You can get paid to do really great projects, and you do all this research and all this stuff in development. Development isn't hell. It is and it isn't. It gives you some time to kind of hang out with your head and, you know, some books and kind of, you know, think, well, this is what I might like to do, and, you know, then work like hell to try to get the draft out and then get it right. But that's what I thought I would do if I was getting notes that I couldn't, because I wouldn't have been able to accommodate. I can't do Heartland. They've never asked me to do an episode of Heartland.
And well, I sure, because you'd probably kill the horse.
First thing we did. Yeah.
Exactly. You killed a horse.
The lie down horse.
I'm surprised you didn't do it on screen.
I did.
Oh, you did do it on screen.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. No, that one we didn't. We killed a pony.
Right.
But not really.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was off screen. Yeah, yeah. I agreed with that note.
And, and the other thing that's funny about that, of course, is in that same episode, there's the baby, and there's the threat that, is he going to kill the baby? And I'm sitting here going, they're not going to kill the baby. But it's Lori. I don't know. they might. I don't know. You never know with you. It's an amazing thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, listen, I guess that probably concludes our session tonight. On behalf of everybody here and on behalf of the Canadian International Television Festival, thank you so much for sharing your time with us. It was a lovely conversation.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, please log on to iTunes and leave us positive feedback, because that helps increase the profile of the show. Or you can always retweet the link to this podcast. If you'd like to follow me on Twitter, my handle is @HeyWriterBoy, or email us at writerstalkingtv@gmail.com. That's writerstalkingtv, all one word, @gmail.com. Special thanks go to TIFF, The Bell Lightbox, CBC, and the Canadian International Television Festival. This podcast is sponsored by the Writers Guild of Canada. The show's technical producer is Philip Vukovich. We'll leave you today with a thought from Dr. Roberta Bondar, Canada's first woman in space. Society needs heroes to rejuvenate, re-energize, and renew itself with visions of the possible. That's what heroes do. I'm Dennis McGrath. Thanks for listening.